We're back with Vid History Makers with my co-host Kevin Pham. And today we're discussing a sort of controversial figure for me. And Kevin and I, we kind of discussed quite in depth on how to approach these kinds of figures because we are children of the South. And I'd like to, you know, figure this out together with Kevin. And Wintydent's story is intertwined with the long and painful conflict that divided Vietnam, divided the North and the South. And in telling her story, we want to acknowledge the deep losses experienced by millions of South Vietnamese, many of whom were forced to flee their homeland. And that includes our families. We aim to reflect on her life with historical accuracy, with historical curiosity, with honesty, all the while holding space for the many perspectives and stories from that era and for people in Vietnam in that area and for people in the Vietnamese American diaspora who left Vietnam. So we want to let our audience know that we are thinking deeply and critically about presenting Wintydent's story in a fair and a balanced way. And I think that hopefully that will allow us to kind of talk about other future figures in a way that's balanced and fair on both sides. And I think we're trying to do the job of illuminating what really happened all throughout the history of Vietnam in the last 1,000 years. So hopefully we do a job of presenting fairly and balance.
Yeah. Our goal here is to better understand Vietnamese history through certain key figures. And Nguyen Thi Dinh is the first person in this series who identifies as a communist. Now, Kenneth, you and I grew up in anti-communist families. You know, there was a terrible civil war in Vietnam. When I was growing up, I heard a lot of bad things about communism from my uncles who fought in the war. Both of my grandfathers were in re-education camps. My mother's father died of malnutrition in one. So the pain that South Vietnamese people have felt as a result of the actions by people who called themselves communists, that pain is really real, and I acknowledge it and I respect it. I'm also very well aware of the horrible crimes that people have committed throughout history in the name of communism. So why are we discussing Nguyen Thi Dinh then? Well, if our goal is to better understand Vietnam, it would be very weird to do a series on historical figures and completely ignore those Vietnamese who considered themselves to be communists. So our goal is to understand how they understood themselves. We don't need to agree with them, but our goal is to just understand how they came to be motivated, why they became communists.
You know, I also want to separate another sort of interesting fact, too, is we don't have that many women leaders in the military in any country, right? In any country in the world, there's not a whole lot of women military leaders. And this is somebody who happened to be a woman and who led guerrilla warfare in a way that, you know, there's a certain way that she approached warfare and approached community. And I think that, you know, despite her involvement in communism and her history with the party, I think we can also talk about this in a sort of, you know, bringing out gender differences during war and the importance of what she did probably for the future, how women were perceived in Vietnam. Because when I go back to Vietnam, I always feel like there's not that big of a struggle the way it is here in the West. But that's probably something that we can really get into deeply that has nothing to do with politics. And I'm interested and curious in that aspect as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And another aspect that looking into her life will shed light on is the question of how did the Viet Cong become a thing?
Yep.
Like what led to the creation of the NLF, the National Liberation Front, what Americans call the Viet Cong, right? How was that created? So her story is the story of how the Viet Minh and later the Viet Cong arose. So
So we promised to commit to covering figures in the history of Vietnam equally. We will go from one party to another party. We'll jump all around. We'll jump to enemies within South Vietnamese government that were enemies amongst each other. There's factions that did not like each other. And I think within the Communist Party, they did not like each other. There was plenty of people that were against each other. And I think we're going to cover all of that. So I just want everybody who is listening, because this series is seeming to really build up, and we're just getting started with all of the coverage. And we just hope that people are patient and people can allow us to do our job of fair and balanced sort of reporting.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
And there are three things that I want to touch on in this episode, three themes. Number one is ideology. What is the role of ideology? What's the role of trust? And what is the role of stories? So those three things, hopefully I'm going to hit them. Let me start with, before we get into the life of Nguyen Thi Dinh, let me start with the word ideology. So the Vietnam Wars, the First Indochina War, the Second Indochina War in particular, these were violent, ideologically driven civil wars. And what is ideology? Well, I want to discuss that in a bit, but Marxism is an ideology. Liberalism is an ideology. Feminism or Black liberation, these are ideologies. Nazism, that's an ideology. Ideologies are really powerful. And the Vietnamese Civil War, it was between, well, Marxist-Leninists who want to control Vietnam. And on the other side, there were non-communists who wanted more pluralism, but also anti-communists who wanted to destroy communism in Vietnam. And during the fight against the French, these differences are still existing. And some Vietnamese hate the communists more than the French even, right? So what I want to talk about here is the role of ideology. So ideologies do one thing in particular. They link thought with action. They link thought with action. So one thing they do is they explain the world. Why are some people rich and some people are poor? Why are there wars? Why do depressions occur? So if you're a Marxist, well, you would explain inequality in terms of, well, there's exploitation, capitalists doing that to the proletariat. But if you're maybe a conservative, you might say, well, some people just work harder than others, right? If you are a Black liberationist, you would say inequality stems from racism. So ideologies explain the world in different ways. Why is something happening? You can give very different explanations. When the French conquered Vietnam, if your ideology was social Darwinism, you would say, well, that's the law of nature. France is stronger than Vietnam. That's what nations do. But if you're a Marxist, you would say, if you're a Leninist, you would say, France did that. Colonialism is a natural outgrowth of capitalism. It's logic. It has nothing to do with people being stronger or weaker. That's one thing ideologies do. They explain. They also give a political program. So what is to be done, who is to do it, and how. So for Marxists, the political program would be the working class needs to unite, they need to gain class consciousness, and they need to overthrow capitalism. Because ideologies, they explain, and they also give the prescription of what to do, right?
Okay, let me stop you right there.
Yeah.
This is a good backdrop for Wintiden, because her ideology probably was not formed yet until somebody got killed, until she lost somebody major. And I can hear in your explanation of the idea of ideology, the concept of ideology, mm-hmm. how Wintiden was affected deeply as a young girl. And I believe two people in her family, her immediate family, were killed by the French. And this really affected her thinking probably at that time.
Yeah. So ideologies propose a program for what to do. Like, again, one more example. If you are a Nazi and you think that a so-called superior race exists, then your goal is to exterminate so-called inferior races, right? That's Nazi ideology. If you're a libertarian, your political program might include proposals for reducing government interference in people's lives, right? So ideologies tell you what to do. Another thing that ideologies do is they give you a sense of identity. They give you a sense of who you are, where you belong. Again, to use the examples I've been using, if you're a communist, you might think of yourself as a member of the working class or of the oppressed, right? If you're a feminist, you might think of yourself first as a woman or a man sympathetic to a woman's to women's problems or belonging to that movement. Lastly, ideologies evaluate what is a good policy, what's a bad policy, right? So a Marxist would ask, well, the policy is good if it helps the working class. A feminist might ask, might say a policy is good if it helps women, etc. So there you go, ideologies. They explain the world. They give you a program of what to do. They give you a sense of identity, and they evaluate certain proposals. All right. I'm glad we had that discussion. So now, should we get into Wintiden?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to know why we chose her, and why her first of all the figures that we could have chose for the communist North.
Yeah. My personal answer is that I had spent 10 years working on a book, as you know, called The Architects of Dignity. I had written about six Vietnamese men. And after I finished writing the book, I kind of felt guilty. How come I'm not looking at any women? And so I was very curious. And so I was doing some research, who were women thinkers and women figures. And Wintiden was simply the first name that came up. She wrote a memoir called No Other Road to Take, and you could read it in English. It's published by Cornell University Press in 1976, but it was originally published in Hanoi in Vietnamese in 1968. But Wintiden herself wrote it in 1965. So as I was reading her memoir, I wanted to know, how did she become this leader? How did she become a leader of a communist revolutionary movement? What attracted her to that movement? And her memoir is a really interesting answer to that question. Let me say something quickly about the translator. The translator is Maya Elliott. And Maya Elliott wrote an amazing book that I recommend to everybody. It's called The Sacred Willow, published by Oxford University Press. It's one of those books that I read maybe when I was 25, and I said to myself, I wish I read this when I was 15.
And just an interesting tidbit here, Maya Elliott has been on the podcast a few years ago. Okay. So here we are, we're talking about Maya Elliott, who, you know, arguably, you know, where does she stand? Why did she decide to translate a communist leader's memoir? And, you know, published by Cornell. And here we are, two sons of the South Vietnamese government. You and I are both curious people, and we want to know. I won't ever shake this initial shock of covering a communist figure, but I'm going to do my best because it's really conflicting within me. And I think it's important that I voice that. And you know, Kevin, you're very steady about why we should do certain things. And I'm trusting that we can cover this fairly. And bringing in Maya Elliott is a very interesting perspective, because I know she is, you know, the decision to cover that memoir and to translate that memoir is a big deal.
I mean, Mai Elliott's family was split ideologically. Her father was anti-communist, but apparently she had at least one sister who was quite sympathetic to communists. Mai Elliott worked for the Americans during the war. She interviewed the Viet Cong to find out their motivations. So she was very well placed to translate this story. And by the way, she was interviewed in the Ken Burns documentary. And I think that she is clearly sympathetic in many ways to Nguyen Thi Dinh. Mai Elliott is also, I think, quite critical of Ngo Dinh Diem's policies. And in her introduction to the memoir, the main point that she wants to get across there is the South communists were a result of Ngo Dinh Diem's repression against peasants and anyone who might sympathize with communists. This is Mai Elliott's kind of argument here, okay? And I'll say more about that, but she's trying to explain how did the South communists or the Viet Cong, the NLF, come to be? Well, it's largely Ngo Dinh Diem's policies, and we'll discuss more of that.
Okay, let's get back to Nguyen Thi Dinh's early life.
So I'm going to do a really quick run through of her biography. So she was born in 1920 in Binh Trea, which is about a 2-hour drive south from Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon. And she died in 1992. So she lived for about 72 years. She joined the anti-French movement when she was a teenager. In 1938, she married a revolutionary friend of her brother, and her husband was then arrested by the French. And then a year later, she was arrested in 1940, and she was sent to a prison camp. And after she was released in 1943, she continued her revolutionary activities. In 1945, she was one of the leaders of the Viet Minh insurrection that seized power in her province, Binh Trea. And in 1946, she was part of a delegation that goes from the south all the way up to Hanoi to report to Ho Chi Minh, to report on the situation in the south, and to ask the north for weapons. And then she herself personally supervised the transport of weapons from the north to the south. And in January of 1960, she leads an uprising in Binh Trea province. And by the way, that year is also where we might say the Viet Cong was created, the National Liberation Front. And at the height of her career in 1965, she became the deputy commander of the National Liberation Front Armed Forces. And this is the highest ranking position held by a woman during the Second Indochina War.
Can I ask you, Kevin, if at any time in her memoir, did she ever discuss, because I never knew, I mean, obviously there had to have been a many Southern people going up north, but I didn't know to what degree, but did she ever talk about in her memoir the idea that a young woman from the South is going up north? I mean, the cultural differences in my mind is so stark. And I didn't know that kind of unity in the early days were present.
Well, it had to be organized, these trips. And I will talk about that in a moment. So what I'd like to do now is kind of go through her memoir, kind of talk about the key things that happened in this memoir. Now, some background information, because a lot of her memoir is set in her home village of Binh Trea. And do you know where that is? Have you been there?
I might have driven by it. I mean, if it's in the south, I mean, I've been to a lot of places in the south, but are we talking about the south, like the Delta or Minh Tây?
Yeah. So in Binh Trea, in the 1940s, there were conflicts between Catholics and the Viet Minh there. So the French would hired a half Vietnamese, half French man to kind of pacify the area. And he got an army of mostly Catholics to resist the Viet Minh. Meanwhile, there's an anti-colonial struggle. And some who side with the French think that they can use the French to get rid of the communists, right? Mm. So this is kind of the background here, that South Vietnam, not everybody was on the same side, right? Yes, they might have wanted to get rid of the French, but they had very different ideas, ideologies of how they want Vietnam to be. So there are these conflicts existing at the time. That's important to note. All right. The memoir starts with her describing her childhood. When she was a kid, her father rowed a boat for hire. That's how he made money. And by the time she was 10 years old, kids would work in the rice fields. And what did she do? She would sell fish at the market. She would wake up at 2 o'clock every morning and arrive at the market really early in the morning. And then she would go home. Her parents wanted to send her to school, but it was too far away, too expensive. And so she studied at home. And this is really important here. Her older brother taught her. Her older brother is about twice her age, and he becomes a really important figure. He would read to her, and she remembers vividly him reading the poem Luc Van Tien. Everyone in Vietnam knows this. And you know this very old tale? There was a movie about it, by the way, but Luc Van Tien, it's one of these old stories. But I'm going to quote her here. She says, "Whenever we had nothing to do at night, we would gather around the oil lamp, my mother lying in the hammock, cradling her grandchild, my father sitting silent in front of a small teapot, my sister sitting around mending clothes. We all kept quiet and listened to my brother read this story fluently." And this is interesting because word soon spreads that in the evenings, the poem was recited in our home. And then as soon as her brother would read it, quote, she says, "The neighbors would all come. Sometimes when I reached the part of the story where Nguyễn Nha, Văn Tiên, and his young valet were harmed by the wicked people, I wept and the neighbors also wept. Once in a while, my father nodded his head in approval and commented, 'This story teaches people all the virtues they must have in life. Humanity, kindness, filial piety, courage, determination, and loyalty.'" This is really remarkable because what this tells me is that she's telling the story of her life. She's making a narrative out of her life. And this is the origin point. It is her sitting as an audience member to her brother reciting a Vietnamese tale, or a Chinese tale, but a Vietnamese tale with these virtues. So she's being imbued with these virtues, humanity, kindness, filial piety, courage, etc. These virtues also happen to be Confucian virtues. And so the poem, Luc Van Tien, was a medium through which they are expressed. And gradually, she says, quote, "The beautiful images of Van Tien and Nguyễn Nha filled my mind. I hated those in the old days who abused their power, position, and wealth to harm our honest people like Van Tien and Nguyễn Nha. But I did not know enough as yet to understand that I should also hate the wicked people who were bringing the miseries and poverty to my family and other families at the time."
You know, it makes me think that everybody who is involved in conflicts on both sides, you know, no matter what we think of them, no matter what side you're on, everybody thinks that they're starting from a very pure place. And we can acknowledge that. We can acknowledge that in the beginning, wherever you start out politically, you're coming from some narrative of justice. And I think that as it goes downstream, people who succeed you, who come after you, you know, arguably could use whatever you've created to do some destruction. And that goes for both sides.
Right. So this becomes crucial here because this poem teaches her to hate people who abuse honest, good people. She hates people who abuse their power. And she connects this to how when she was 10 years old, she tells this traumatizing story where there's an abusive drunk landlord of their family. He arrives drunk at their home and he demands to be fed. And her parents are so poor that they don't have enough food to give him. So what do? They slaughter her pet hen that she had been raising as a little kid. And this hen is slaughtered for the drunk landlord to eat. So now she's furious and she demands her parents to compensate for the hen. This anger is so powerful. And so she's desperate, trying to make sense of it. And so this is an opportunity for her brother, her older brother who I'd mentioned. He takes her aside and he explains to her, right? Remember what I said about ideologies? They explain the world. He explains to her that the landlord was a class of people created partly by the French. They are just like the colonizers. The class of landlords and the colonizers only seek to exploit and abuse poor people. And so she says, quote, "It was from that time onward that I knew my brother was making revolution. I began to understand and to firmly believe that making revolution was a good thing." This is the power of ideology. So now she keeps that anger and she's channeling it into action. So she asks her brother, "Tell me what to do. I want to fight against these evil landlords, these colonizers." So her brother gives her jobs to deliver letters and propagandize people in the hamlets and the village to join mutual aid associations, to encourage people to buy certain newspapers, to mobilize women in the town. And so she says, "Whatever task I was given, I performed with a lot of zeal." Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. Origin story, right? It really shows, you know, how it can drive your future.
Right. And this kind of reminds me of, I have a friend in California who's quite on the left politically. And he, when we talk about voters, like the white working class who are angry, he does not dismiss them and call them racist. You know, he's trying to get them onto his ideology because he knows that the right can co-opt angry people. So when people are angry, their anger, you know, ideologies are going to compete to get them on the side, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that she does all this work. And then a few years later, she, as a teenager, she reaches puberty and her parents are trying to marry her off, basically. And so several sent matchmakers to my house, I'm quoting her, to ask for my hand. "My parents wanted me to accept and give me away in marriage to put an end to their worries," because, by the way, her parents are really worried about the revolutionary activity that she's doing. They don't want her to get in trouble. But she says, "I absolutely refused to go along. I often confided to my brother, I only want to work for the revolution. I don't want to get married yet." So she defies her parents' wishes. And this is interesting because remember the poem, Luk Van Tien, it expresses Confucian virtues, but she's going to reinterpret ideas like filial piety, righteousness, loyalty as piety, not towards her parents, but to her country. That's how she reinterprets these Confucian values. So her brother means a lot to her. And another important thing happens. He gets arrested by, quote, puppet village officials, she says, for his revolutionary activity. And she wonders why. So she often visits him in jail to bring him food. And another thing happens while she's visiting him in prison. And she sees for the first time, quote, scenes of brutal torture. That very same landlord that ate her hen was now hitting prisoners with sticks while drinking and while screaming. So you can imagine that she's a young teenager seeing her beloved brother in prison being abused, and she's just getting angrier and angrier. Okay. And I'm going to quote her again because I think this moment really sticks out, I think, in the memoir. She says, "Then the landlord ordered his cronies to beat the prisoners with large sticks, tie their hair, and hoist them to the ceiling by the hair. My brother was not the only one who was tortured. Many other old and young people were also tortured. Many men were beaten until they passed out, blood trickling from their mouths, heads, and feet, and dyeing the cement floor a grayish and purplish color. I loved my brother, and I hated the soldiers so intensely that I wanted to run out to hold them back and defend my brother, but I was too frightened, so I just stood there frozen and wept in anger. For many long months, I saw each day with my own eyes the arrogant and brutal soldiers beat up my brother and many other people, and it was at that moment that a thought sprang up in my innocent mind. Why are good and capable men who are loved by the people and their families, like my brother, suddenly being beaten so savagely? Why is the gang of Canton Chief Moon, that's the landlord, abusing their power and position to oppress poor and kind people like my brother? So this is important here because she's angry and now she has questions. Why are good people like my brother being beaten? Again, she's ripe for an ideology to explain that for her. And it's really here that communist ideology takes hold. It explains it quite clearly. They are abusing your brother because that is their class. They are the exploiting class, and that is the logic of capitalism. And the solution here is to overthrow the capitalist class, the landlord class.
You know, Kevin, I want to stop you here. Oftentimes in my family growing up, we would talk about my father's father. And, you know, at the time, I knew that my father's father was in Sokjang or Ganta, one of those towns. He was the chief of police, the head honcho of the police force in 1940, 1941 to 43. He worked for the French, and he was killed by, at the time, Viet Minh, right? This is like a known fact. So whenever I thought about these things as a child, I was like, oh my God, I felt so bad for my grandfather and my dad. You know, my dad was 6 months old. He lost his grandfather, but he was working for the French. And I never really thought about that until like I got older. I went to college and then I started studying anthropology and sort of this idea of colonizing. And I thought, wait a minute, my grandfather worked for the French. Mm. And we think about this, he was in direct opposition to the people of Vietnam at the time. He was working for the colonizer. And that often puts me at such a weird predicament when I think about the love of French culture. Because on one hand, it's like, okay, we love the food, the music, and all these things that the French brought to our culture. But at the same time, when we hear stories like Wintiden, the conflict of really governance of our own people come into question. Like Wintiden is the exact reason why, you know, questions that I have about my father's father serving the French was not the ideal thing for a Vietnamese person to do, you know, looking back. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah.
Need parts now? O'ReillyAuto.com offers in-store pickup, same-day home delivery, or next-day home shipping. Get more parts your way at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So conflicting. It's conflicting when you think about it, right?
Right. And I want to get back to how Nguyen Thi Dinh would see people who worked for the French, because they actually put them into different categories. I'll get there later. But for now, I just want to quote her again and say that. So she says, I make revolution to overthrow the landlords who are oppressing and exploiting us, like Canton Chief Moon, that's her landlord, and also to overthrow the French who have stolen our country from us. Her brother explained to me at great length, but I did not understand anything more than, that the communists loved the poor and opposed the officials in the village. My love for my brother and the men who had been jailed blossomed and deepened with such new and significant events. So what's significant here is that, number one, you have this intense anger and she's trying to make sense of it. And now she's going to channel that hatred and that anger towards the so-called enemy who are abusing her brother and the people that she loves. We can see these social bonds and these emotional bonds, this love, this trust being built around a particular group and then putting all the anger on another group, right? The French, the landlords, the capitalists. And so what starts happening is that many different comrades start going to their house because she's cooking for them and they treat her with affection. And she works for her brother and the comrades. She's distributing pamphlets. She couldn't really read them well, but they kind of used her status as a young girl because she's not very suspicious, right? She can go around town distributing pamphlets and she could say, oh, I don't know how to read. I don't know what these say. You know, I'm just... But she knew that the pamphlets were an appeal to the peasants to oppose cruel rich people and village officials. And they would praise her and she would feel good about that and she would do it more, you know? So here we see the cycle of how this activism gets going. It's the love of the people that come to her house. So now her parents want her to get married and she says no. But then eventually they kind of convince her and she says, okay, if I get married, I want to marry a revolutionary. And there's one of the comrades that goes to the house. He's this older intellectual revolutionary man named Bic. And he kind of woos her and then they get married. So now they're married. There are two revolutionaries and they have a child. Then one day, Bic, her husband, is arrested by security police agents just a year after they get married. And so he's in prison now. And one of her comrades comes to the home and he tells her, look, we need to break your husband out of prison. They want us to operate. And so now she's debating, what should I do? Should I join this movement? What do I do with my baby? Should I leave the baby at home? Like, these are the dilemmas that she's confronted with. So she visits her husband in prison with the baby, and they're allowed only 15 minutes. And she's asking him, like, what should I do? I want to work for the revolution, but what should I do with the baby? By the way, this is July of 1940. And she plans to leave the baby behind with her parents so that she can work on revolutionary things.
And are we still in Benjia?
Yes. So on the way home from the prison, she is arrested by security police. For 3 weeks, she's in prison and they interrogate her about her husband's activities and her activities. She says she's ignorant about everything. She just wants to raise the child. Eventually, she gives the baby to her mother. She's heartbroken, okay? And then she and other prisoners are taken to basically a prison camp at a mountain near Cambodia, Bara. And there are Frenchmen and armed soldiers. So she's at a prison camp now. And what she does is she builds solidarity with these prisoners. They stick together. The prisoners stick together. And then the men who are also there, who are in prison, they plan to kill one of the officers. So one day, one of the officers forces six men to dig a grave to bury a dead man. After the men finish digging, they use the shovel to beat him to death, the officer, and they bury him right there. So what's interesting here is that prisons play such an important role in creating the communist revolutionary movement. Peter Zinnemann wrote a great book called The Colonial Bastille, and it's about how prisons in Vietnam really generated this solidarity among revolutionaries who would later hold the top positions in the Communist Party. Why were prisons so powerful? Because you're stuck there, you're angry, and you're building trust and solidarity. Vietnam is an interesting case that's different from Soviet Russia and China in that there are not many purges in the top leadership of the Communist Party. You know, like you have Stalin erasing people out of photos, right? Traitors. But in Vietnam, there was really actually a lot of solidarity being built because of those horrible experiences in these prisons. Anyway, so she's in prison there for 3 years. She gets out in 1943 and they put her under house arrest. She's excited to finally see her son, who she hasn't seen in that whole time. He's now 4 years old. And she's excited to see her husband. But when she gets out, he's nowhere to be seen. And no one has heard from him for 2 years. Eventually, she finds out that he died in Côn Đảo Island, which, by the way, Phan Thuy Trinh was in prison there. So this is all linked together here. So we have to imagine she's in unbearable pain and anger. And the biggest pain for her is that she didn't want to tell her son that her father died. That the son's father died. And this is really painful. She thinks of suicide, but then, quote, I'm going to quote her, "When I looked at my son, when I thought of my husband's death, when I remembered the brothers and sisters in the revolution, when I recalled the days of sufferings and hardships in the prison camp, I felt my resolve return. And I told myself I must live to bring up my son and to avenge my husband and comrades. For this reason, I became even more attached to the revolution." Boo. We are better understanding the dynamics of what's keeping her going. This is so fascinating because the story of Hai Bat-chung is quite similar. The older sister in that story fights against the Chinese because she wants to avenge her husband. So similarly here, Nguyen Thi Dinh wants to avenge her husband, okay?
But, you know, when I'm listening to this story as a son of the South, I'm thinking about, yes, origin stories are fascinating. Origin stories give us a particular insight into why there were motivations from a girl from the South who joined forces with the North to fight the South, right? And when I think about this, I think about, okay, it's great. We can, in essence, glorify somebody's origin story. But at what point do we look at the repercussions downstream of what this revolutionary did to the people of the South or the South Vietnamese government, right? And I'm interested in that at some point. I just wanted to kind of interject that. There's a lot of things that I'm addressing, and I know you have to go through your biography, but we're very limited on time. But at the same time, I want to throw that out there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, at this time, she is in the South, and there is apparently a very strong pro-Japanese movement, very active in the countryside. They're recruiting. And she doesn't say exactly, but I believe she's referring to the Cao Dai. Like, they were quite pro-Japanese. They thought they could work with the Japanese to get rid of the French. But of course, many others disagree, and they think the Japanese are very cruel. They're fascists. So the Viet Minh is now operating in the South. This is the mid-1940s. She gets into contact with them. She starts working for them. And in August of 1945, this is the famous August Revolution, she helps to seize power for the Viet Minh in Minh Tre. She carries the flag, okay? And after that August of 1945, she's assigned to build up the women's network in villages and nearby districts. And then she's elected to lead this women's association. So this was a delegation of mothers, sisters, young girls to go to the front to greet the troops and to give them gifts for Tet. And this is very powerful also to her because now she takes she meets soldiers and she feels so bad for them. Like, she just is moved, you know, she wants to help. And then the big moment comes when she is asked to be part of a delegation to go up north to Hanoi to meet with Ho Chi Minh and to ask for weapons to supply the South. So they take a boat and then a train to Hanoi. It's her first time outside of Minh Tre province. So you had mentioned, you know, like she's a country girl. She's never been outside of Vintra, but now she's seeing her country for the first time, really. And she's so excited. She's just full of love and joy for the people in the North. She's very happy. And she describes meeting Ho Chi Minh by saying she felt, quote, the love of an old father for his children. And Ho Chi Minh points to her and he says, "Women have the priority to speak first. Tell me about the situation of our people and the troops in the South. What do they lack at this moment? What do you need? What do you want to propose?" And before she even asks for weapons, which is her main goal, he says, "You must need weapons," right? So she kind of characterizes Ho Chi Minh as this kind of wise, knowing father figure. And she says, "Yes, that's right. We need weapons." And he says, "Okay, we're going to try, but I want you to seize weapons from the French. You need to fight them. You need to get their weapons." So she returns to the South. She starts working for a resistance committee there, taking in deliveries of weapons and money by boat coming from the North. So she's pretending to be a fishing boat, but she's transporting personally all of these guns, these different kinds of machine guns and rifles. And so her and her crew realize that it's actually safer to travel during a storm. Like the enemy is more dangerous than natural, challenges. So when they reach the shore one night, transporting all these weapons, they encounter other Vietnamese and they don't know what side they're on. Like everybody's very suspicious, you know, which side do you work on? So her crew is separated and interrogated and she pretends to just be a merchant. And she asks the person directly, "Is this a French area or a Viet Minh area?" And the person's like, "I'm not telling you." And then one person, one of the youth, writes a report. And at the very top of the paper, he writes, "The Democratic Republic of Vietnam, independence, freedom, and happiness." And she like is so happy because then she realizes that they're on the same side. And so she writes, "Suspicion suddenly gave way to trust." And then they laugh and they hug and they realize they're comrades. And so she gives them weapons. And so she continues to work. But all the meanwhile, the French are trying to control all of South Vietnam. And so the Viet Minh, they constantly need to retreat to a swampy forest and they need to cultivate land. So I'm talking a lot so far, but is there anything that strikes you so far in this story?
No, I mean, you know, we can paint such a lovely picture of the birth of a revolutionary, you know, but it still worries me that, you know, down the line, we just need to kind of see, you know, what kind of harm,
yeah,
you know, what was there anything wrong with her ideology? You know, I want to see how we can balance our family in the South, right? I'm using this as a sort of a sounding board for like, I mean, is somebody so perfect in the North? Are we talking about a narrative that's so beautiful that we forget that there were downstream, there was a lot of angst and pain? Or are we just going to say, you know, this was one of the perfect people in the party, in the Communist Party, and we're just going to leave it at that?
No, yeah. So we're going to get there very, very, very quickly. I just want to finish kind of getting in her mind a little bit here to understand why she feels so strongly that the communist revolutionaries are the ones to lead Vietnam. One thing that struck me in this memoir was that she sees Ngo Dinh Diem and his henchmen, she says, as fat. Like they eat a lot. She says Ngo Dinh Diem ate so much of the leftover milk and butter of the Americans that he's become as fat as a sow about to have a litter. And so anytime they see two large comrades, they immediately say, "Are you guys landlords?" But so it's kind of like how you look, right? But one thing that's really important to keep in mind is that during this time, Ngo Dinh Diem is really cracking down on any perceived communist sympathizers in the South. Like, they use guillotines and prisons. And this is about 50,000, I've heard, were imprisoned between, I want to get the dates right, but between 1955, yeah, when Diem gets into power, to 1960, 50,000 people are imprisoned. And I've read P.J. Honey wrote that there's a consensus that most of those people in those prisons were actually not communists nor communist sympathizers. But anyway, but there are re-education camps that Ngo-Dinh Diem's government is creating, forcing people to denounce communism. And so this is important to say, because she and her comrades are going to say, we must arm ourselves to survive, otherwise we'll die. So it becomes self-defense. So if you permit us to kill the security police agents to obtain weapons, we'll do it right away. Like, somebody's asking her that. Can we do that? The Americans, quote, and Diem have torn up the Geneva Accords long ago. We cannot be kind to the devil. So the Geneva Accords basically did three important things. Number one, they split Vietnam into two countries, right? 17th parallel, North Vietnam top, South Vietnam bottom of that. It also allowed for a period of 300 days of movement, choose a side. And it also called for elections to unify the country. But it's important to keep in mind that Ngo-Dinh Diem and the South Vietnamese and the Americans, they actually never signed that. They never agreed to those elections, which is interesting. By the way, I don't know if you know who Pierre Asselin is, but he's a scholar of Vietnam war history. But he actually makes the case that if elections were held, and I'm going off a tangent here, but if elections were held, he thinks that Ngo-Dinh Diem actually would have won and Ho Chi Minh would have lost. Everybody says the opposite. But Pierre Asselin says Ngo-Dinh Diem would have won because, well, in the north, in the mid-50s, things are going terribly there. You have a terrible mistakes made during the land reform. They're suffering. Whereas in the south, things are actually going quite well. Anyway, that's...
Ngo-Dinh Diem sounds, from my family's history, from the people that I grew up with, he was a hero to the Vietnamese northerners who came down to the south, the million person migration to the south. Bac Nam Tu, he was a hero to many. And I think, you know, we'll tease it out now, I think he's probably the next figure that we should talk about. Ngo-Dinh Diem, right?
Yeah. So I think just to summarize what the key things that I have tried to touch on here is, number one, the power of ideology. That's really important to explain your situation. The trust and love and solidarity built between her and her brother and her comrades, right? And the power of stories, like the Luc Van Tien. These serve to motivate her. Now, we get to the question of, okay, these origin stories are great and they make sense, right? But of course, they can spiral out of control, because once you are engaged in a war, you're going to see enemies and you're going to do things to perceived enemies that create a cycle of conflict, right? So at a conference, she wrote how she and her comrades, they divided village officials and security police agents and informers into three categories. So A, there were tyrants who had blood debts toward the people. So these were the really bad people who needed to be taken care of, right? B, there were those who were lukewarm towards their service to the Diem regime. And C, there were those who were forced to serve. And so they categorize these people in order to decide how to respond to them. Landlords were also divided into three categories. A, those who acted as henchmen for the enemy, I'm quoting, or relied on the enemy to suppress the people. B, those who were neutral. And C, those who had children serving in the revolution.
Wow. Complex. Complex picture. Very complex. And I'm like, where does my grandfather fit into all of this? Did he have a gun pointed to his head to serve the French, you know?
Right. Ooh.
Yeah. Very tricky. And I don't think that was the case. I think that there were privileges that were bestowed upon you if you were French educated, if you were given the keys to the car, to the kingdom of France, right?
Yeah.
And you lived off the fat of the French because they paid you very well to control your people. Ooh, such a heavy thought to think about.
Yeah. But I guess to go back to your question of, okay, great story, but the communists did terrible things as well, right? I mean, but we can imagine that if you grew up seeing your loved ones be tortured, you're gonna use that anger and you might do terrible things yourself, right? Or support.
Yeah. And, you know, I think once you become, you go into an ideology all in, you go all in into an ideology, you're going to do whatever it takes to accomplish. And I just, in this conversation, I just realized that you said Ngô Đình Diệm created re-education camps. I mean, so that is another thing. So this is where it begins, right? So this idea of re-education camp. You know, I've interviewed somebody years ago who said that one of the biggest problems that the French Vietnamese communists, so these were communists that were in the 60s that were in support of the Vietnamese communists in country, what they had a problem with once the war was over was this idea of putting political prisoners into education camps. Mm-hmm. And they had a big problem. They said, from that point, we split in the mid-70s, late-70s. We split from the party because we just did not agree with putting the former South Vietnamese officials into camps. We didn't agree with that. But now I'm like, wait, so Ngô Đình Diệm started this, you know, in his time in power.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a war of ideologies, right? Like, they might all agree that they don't want to live under the French, but they have such different visions for how to create a new Vietnam here.
Yeah. So, and how did, yeah. So how did she sort of after, you know, cause I know that she was very particular in her use of women in the war. Can you talk a little bit about that? And yeah.
So throughout her memoir, she talks about how her role as a mother was quite important because she was faced with all these dilemmas, you know, like, should I raise my son or should I go join the revolutionaries? And what is the proper role of women? She was charged with unifying women. And so one thing they did was they would go give gifts to the boys at the front lines, you know, to provide moral support. And they also used, as I had mentioned, their status as women to seem innocent so that they could use it to their advantage and go passing around pamphlets and things like that, transporting weapons. You know, if you're a woman, you could just say, I'm a merchant, I'm not a fighter, right? So they were kind of using this. Have you been to the Women's Museum in Hanoi?
Well, I have not.
It is a really interesting museum. And I mean, it portrays the Vietnamese Communist Revolution as really coming from the work of women. And it was interesting being there with women, because I would ask them, like the people who I'm traveling with, how did you experience that museum? And it was interesting that several times I've heard from women, and by the way, these are not Vietnamese women, these are American women, but they told me that they felt that women were kind of being used, you know, for propaganda purposes. I don't know how else to respond to this, but
one of the pictures that we often see that has been uncovered is, I think they are wearing ao ba ba, which is like the short, you know, they're not long tunics like ao dài. They're like cut up to the waist and white. They're in white tops and black bottoms, and then they have their face covered to kind of protect their identities, and they're crossing bridges and they're, you know, fighting in the trenches in the north. And I wonder if that's around the time of Winteden.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, they called them the long-haired soldiers.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is what she started. This is what she kind of, you know, really brought to the war.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm curious about how she rose in power to become Vietnam's first vice president, right? After the war.
Yeah. That part is not as clear to me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how that happened. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that is also a very interesting part of history, although we don't know how that happened, but it's very telling of sort of the Communist Party at that time, having a woman rise up and becoming a vice president. I mean, what that does for, or what that signals for women in a country like Vietnam is, you know, it's heavily patriarchal, and to have a Vietnamese vice president, a woman, is a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, I've also heard that patriarchy in Vietnam is actually a result of French domination and Chinese domination, Chinese culture, and Confucianism. But pre-Chinese Vietnamese, it's actually quite even matriarchal and in some circumstances.
Well, you know, the running joke is really, you know, if you really want to dig deep into family structures, it's always the women who are holding the purse strings. You know, it's always women who are controlling. I mean, that was in my family. My father was on the outside working, but my mother was the one who really, you know, handled the money. And I've noticed a lot of families are like that.
Yeah. What's interesting is that around this time, the 1940s, 1930s, 40s, women were confronted with, well, what does it mean to be a good woman? You know, because you had this Confucian context, but now you have this revolutionary context. Should you rebel against your parents and join the revolution? There's a great book by Patricia Norland, and it's actually a collection of oral history narratives of Vietnamese women from Saigon, privileged women who decided to give up their privilege to go to the maquis, to the jungle, to fight the French in the 1950s. So the question there is, what inspired them to go to join the resistance? And a lot of them said it was actually being an audience member to theater, which was interesting. So these young women would put on plays about Vietnamese stories, fighting the Chinese, and it would generate the solidarity, because if you were an audience member, you were so moved by it, you would then learn an instrument and then join the troop and like travel far to perform for the troops. And so people are in the jungle, they're singing songs, they're putting on plays. It's fun, right? So it's interesting to see how these dynamics of revolution happen. You know,
so she's a national hero for the Communist Party. But do we ever in the South hear about her? Because growing up, I never heard about her. I mean, is it something that, you know, she rose to become vice president of the State Council, and she's one of the highest ranking female leaders in Vietnam post-war government. And, you know, it's something that it's completely blind to me. I'm completely blind to it because, you know, we don't follow that history in politics. But how do we in the South, and this is probably just a rhetorical question that I'm putting out there, how do we in the South view her? And if there are people leaving comments, we would love to hear how she's looked at in the South, Vietnamese, from that perspective. Was she a good person that handled her business in the way that it was fair and balanced in her world? Or was she sort of like this, one of these figures who were evil in history, who really took advantage of power when she got there? I would love to hear that.
Yeah, these are great questions.
Yeah, and that leads me to probably the same time period, which is Ngo Dinh Diem, right? We just talked about him. And I'd like to tease out, this is an organic process between you and me, between us, you know, I would like to talk about him next. And I'd like to talk about the powerful forces that surrounded him during that time in history.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking forward to talking about him as well. I mean, I asked my parents, what do you think of Ngô Đình Diệm? They gave very different reactions. My dad said, he's bad. But my mom was like, oh no, he's great. He's good. My mom is very Catholic.
Yeah, my mother loved him. And my mother says that there are people that, you know, really, really worship that guy. And it's, I want to hear about it because I think that he comes with there's a mixed bag there. And I think that talking about Ngô Đình Diệm could be illuminating to hear that not all of Vietnam was unified during that time. This is a very tricky part of our history.
Yeah, well, I look forward to that.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for another complicated breakdown that you really helped to illuminate. And I hope our audience please leave questions and comments because we'd love to hear more because maybe we can revisit somebody like Nguyễn Thị Định in the future and talk more about the things that we left out.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.